Dr. Luck, it's great to see you. You're going to need to unmute and turn your camera on. Oh, there you are.
Hey.
Good morning.
Morning.
So it's 9:45. I'm assuming that KPT has us up and running. And as I mentioned before, we were on air with KPTZ. This will be our last weekly update from our good doctors. We are moving to a once a month schedule, and we're looking at the third Monday of each month to be broadcasting on KPTZ and having our regular updates. So adjust your calendars, community, and get used to a different cycle for this update. But it's kind of fitting that our last weekly update is with Dr. Locke, because I started off my tenure as a commissioner with Dr. Locke at the helm here. So take it away, Tom.
Well, thank you, and good to see everyone today, and welcome to my new office in Port Angeles. Since we last met, my wife Jeanette and I have moved to Port Angeles, so we're now city residents, probably for the first time in 40 years for me. It's my pleasure to fill in for Dr. Berry this week, and I'll start, as she often does, just with a quick review of the numbers. Internationally, COVID has been in decline through the summer, but that decline reversed itself by the middle of September. So now internationally, COVID rates and hospitalization and deaths are starting to go up again. We're especially seeing this in Europe and parts of Asia. In the United States as a whole, we're still in a lull. Case rates are continuing to drop. And as the commissioners, I'm sure, know at this point, case rates are not a very good measure anymore, since our testing strategies have changed a lot. But hospitalization and death rates are still a very good measure. And hospitalizations are down very slightly nationally. Death rate is down 6%. So the average daily death rate now in the US is below 400. It's 361. And then another measure that we're using more and more is wastewater surveillance. So looking at virus in wastewater. And that's still low in the U.S., although it's starting to rise in some Northeast states, could be a harbinger of things to come. In Washington state, we're in the lower quartile of states. We're 36th among states in terms of COVID activity. Cases are down about 24%. Hospitalizations, death rates are also down. So on average, there's about 9 people die in Washington state every day from COVID. You know, that's still a very significant number. Jefferson County's 2-week case rate is at 243, which is a declining trend from what it's been. And there are currently 2 people in the hospital in Jefferson County with COVID. In Clallam County, the case rate is 136. Per 100,000 with 1 hospitalization. And then in terms of monkeypox virus, MPV, we're now in the 8th week of a declining rate nationally and also in Washington state. So that's good news. So far in the state, we've had over 600 cases. One of them was in Clallam County, none so far in Jefferson County, 5 of them in Kitsap County. And we're moving ahead with vaccination programs, and the vaccine is becoming more and more available, and the indications for the vaccine are widening. I'd also like to just mention influenza. That should be on all our radar screens as well. And right now, influenza activity is minimal in Washington state. There's some early increases in the southeast United States. But when we try to predict what's going to happen in the northern hemisphere, we usually look at the southern hemisphere as a clue. And What happened this past summer in Australia and New Zealand is worrisome. They both had an early influenza season, and the influenza season was unusually severe. And that's what we're expecting in the US this year, in that we had 2 years of virtually no significant seasonal flu. And this was because of all the masking and distancing we were doing for COVID. But that also means that population immunity to influenza drops. And also at the same time, vaccination rates went down the last 2 years. So we're being set up for a more severe flu season this year. I think that the question I'm often getting nowadays is what comes next? What is the forecast? And a quote I like to use, this is Michael Osterholm from the University of Minnesota. He has a saying that the COVID pandemic is a three-act play, and we are still in act two of this play. So not only is it not over, but the next act is something that there's a lot of uncertainty as to how it's going to play out. At least the early part of Act Three, it's going to have a lot to do with seasonality, with population immunity, and then how we respond, how we use the tools we have available to mitigate the impacts of the pandemic. And for most people, we can't do a lot about seasonality, that as the days get shorter, people spend more time indoors, that the cool, dry air is actually favorable for virus survival. So those things increase our exposure risk. Population immunity is something that's been steadily increasing. And that's the combination of the immunity we get from vaccines and from natural infection. And vaccine rates, although they've kind of stalled nationally, they're still significant. You know, with 68% of Americans fully vaccinated, in Washington State it's 75%, 79% in Jefferson County, and about 70% in Clallam. And also there's significant natural immunity that's developed. There was one study that estimated that up to 80% of people in the US were exposed to Omicron in these last 11 months that it's been circulating. So the combination of those two at this point means there's a lot more population immunity than there was earlier on in the pandemic. And if the virus would just stop mutating, we would be in very good shape in terms of the pandemic. But of course, that's not how evolution works. You know, as the virus as population immunity increases, the strains of virus that circulate are the ones that are able to evade this immunity, and so that's exactly what's happening. And it's a kind of competition right now between the existing BA4 and BA5, which not only have we developed a lot of immunity to, but are included in the new bivalent vaccine. It's a competition between this and these new subvariants that are starting to arise around the world. There's a whole long list of them, but there's three of them that we're really focusing on. What's called BQ1 and 1.1, which is a spinoff of the BA5. This is the one that seems to be moving the fastest in the US. It's doubling every 1 to 2 weeks, which is a sign that it's a very effective competitor to the other virus strains. And then even more worrisome is this one called XBB that's sort of currently taking off from Singapore, and one that we were really concerned about about a month ago. It's even a more ungainly title of BA2.75.2. And these are both highly immune evasive. And there's something that not only have the potential of causing infection in people who have been previously exposed or previously immunized. But very concerning is the fact that they're resistant to the monoclonal antibodies that we use to protect people who are immunosuppressed or to treat people who have severe disease and are hospitalized. So we run the risk of losing those effective tools as these subvariants predominate. Right now, it looks like the BQ1 and 1.1 are the ones that are most likely to be the next wave in the U.S. And I often get questions about this. What are these mutations? You know, I think there's this common belief that these are radical mutations of the virus, but actually they're very subtle mutations. They're just very tiny shifts of an area of the virus known as the receptor binding domain. And this is a critical area. This is how the virus attaches to our cells. And it's also where the antibodies we develop to defend ourselves attach to the virus. So if that area changes, then the antibodies don't work as well, and the virus is able to infect our cells. Fortunately, though, our immune system is much more sophisticated than that. And even if we get infected, we still have a second line of defense that is triggered by vaccination and natural immunity that has to do with these white blood cells known as T cells. And that's basically why vaccines, even if they can't prevent all infection, still do an incredibly good job at preventing severe illness, hospitalization, and deaths. So in summary, I'd say in terms of forecasts, COVID rates almost certainly are going to go up this month. And how bad it's going to be will depend a lot on which subvariants are predominant and how severe they might be. It's a very good idea to get a bivalent booster and to do so as soon as possible, because based on the fact that rates are rising rapidly now in Britain and Europe, we think the same thing is going to be happening in the U.S. in about a month, so right around Thanksgiving time. And then, as I said, influenza, it's likely to be earlier this year and more severe, so probably around that Thanksgiving time again, the so-called twindemic that the media has been talking about. And some people are even talking about a triple-demic, because if you factor in this respiratory virus known as RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, which has been around for a very long time, but is a very severe in infants, so children under 1 year of age, and then in the elderly or the immunosuppressed. And this is something. We've been working on a vaccine for this for the last 50 years, and we think we're pretty close. There's a very promising adult vaccine that's in final clinical trials. There may be a pediatric vaccine within 4 or 5 years, but right now we don't have any vaccine for this, and it's filling up the pediatric ICUs in many areas of the country. So we're watching that really carefully. So our response is what it's been for a long time. That is, you know, vaccination remains key, masking in high-risk settings, and when you're trying to protect the vulnerable, ventilation, I try to keep mentioning over and over, and that's something we're under-investing in, and it's really hugely significant. There was one very good study that suggests we could prevent 80% of school-based infections just with better ventilation systems in the school. And that's not just COVID. It's all the respiratory viruses that often spread in schools and then move out into the community. So there are some national initiatives to invest in better ventilation. And then finally, we have good treatments for people who are severely ill or people who are at risk of serious complications. Things like Paxlovid are very effective at reducing severity of illness and risk of hospitalization. So just look at the time here. I think I probably have time just to briefly mention one other area, and that is something I've been working on a lot, and we can't lose sight of, and that is pandemic preparedness, where not only do we have a ways to go in this pandemic, but we have to stay prepared for future ones. And any pandemic is kind of a stress test of your system. It tells you what's working and what's not working. And so far, we have found a lot of things that are not working about our system that we need to be addressing, and now's the time to do it. The way I'm working on this is we have a statewide process. It's called the Public Health Advisory Board, and it was set up by the legislature to look at the whole public health system, but especially right now how we responded to the pandemic, and look for ways to improve things. And there are national efforts similar to this underway, and there's some common things now everyone agrees on that we need to focus on. First of all, our data and surveillance systems are woefully inadequate. For much of the pandemic, we were flying blind, at least in terms of US data. And we made a lot of our big decisions based on data from Britain and Israel and South Africa, who had, turns out, have much better data systems. So we need to improve those at a local and state and national level. Personal protective equipment. Although we have adequate supplies right now, we still have inadequate stockpiles, and we don't have the capacity in the United States to make more. That's something we should have fixed a long time ago, but we haven't. I mentioned already improving ventilation in public places. And then we need to get better at rapid response, you know, being able to deploy vaccines and medications more rapidly and more equitably. That's something we've fallen down on. So with that, with my comprehensive update, I hope to just ask the commissioners if you had any questions.
Thanks for being here, Dr. Locke. We really appreciate it. It's nice to see you again. I was just going to say I got my shot on Saturday at the mass vaccination clinic, and Dr. Berry was there giving shots, and it felt like there was a rock star in the room. And mm-hmm. I feel like we have another one in the room with us this morning. So any questions for Dr. Locke and from us this morning?
I do. I have one. Nice to see you, Dr. Locke. I can't believe it's been 2.5 years since I said, what would you think about doing a weekly update to the BOCC? It seems like we're going to need current information. I'm curious, what is the status of the ability to do some sort of titer testing to understand immunity? Will we get to a place where we can have some sense of how much immunity we have in our system to be able to assess when we might get another vaccine or when we need to be really cautious? Or is that something we can anticipate?
Well, we have very precise testing we can match up antibodies that are produced or present in people's blood to specific variants and subvariants of the virus. Most of that is available in research settings. There are very few of them that have been deployed on a mass level or are available to clinicians. Although there are some, you know, for instance, there are tests that are readily available to see if you've been exposed to COVID. So if you have antibodies, there are even tests to differentiate whether that exposure or that immunity came from vaccination or from natural immunity. But beyond that, we don't have any readily available tests to look at the subvariants, and that's what we need to increase, especially in terms of the ability to produce vaccines that are better matches for what's circulating now. And the latest bivalent vaccine was actually pretty impressive. That one of the good things about messenger RNA vaccines is you can produce them really quickly. Once you decide what to make, you can start cranking it out in just a couple months, which is extraordinary. You know, with flu vaccine, which a lot of it's still made in eggs, it takes 9 months to produce the vaccine. So yeah, if we had a system tuned up better, we could do, the hope is we could get ahead of the virus and immunize people against the variant that we thought was coming, not the one that just moved through the community.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised how much vaccine fatigue I'm hearing, even from people who have been very enthusiastic about mm-hmm. getting vaccinated previously. People just saying, oh, but don't I have enough immunity? And so it's, you know, I wonder if getting to a place where they could have some sense if they had enough immunity or not, like we do with TB, right? But it sounds like because it's still mutating quickly, that's not realistic.
Well, I think that what I urge people to look at it is you know, immunity is something that you develop and modify over time. So you start with vaccination, ideally, but most vaccinated people are going to be exposed to COVID, and they're going to get infected with it, whether they know it or not. You know, ideally, they won't even know it, in the sense that their immunity will be good enough that they don't even know they're infected. But their immune system will, and will get benefit from it. So that's how we get out of this ultimately, is we get our immune systems as robustly proficient in fighting the virus as they can be. And then when we do get infected, it's a mild kind of thing. The real problem with the pandemic was not the fact that the people who got mild respiratory infections. The problem was the people who were hospitalized, who died, and very significantly, the people who have long COVID, you know, which is something we're just starting to grapple with, but is probably something we will remember long after this pandemic has passed, is the number of people that are still with us who were permanently injured as a result of this infection.
I have a couple quick questions. It's great to see you, Dr. Locke, and it is, it's nice synchronicity having you here today. Wondering, you said that some of the new strains of COVID are more resistant to the monoclonal antibodies, and I'm wondering if there's ever any lessening of effect of the antivirals that has been?
In theory, there could be, but so far, not. So Paxlovid, remains highly effective at moderating the infection, and the other oral antiviral molnupiravir, it's not that it's lost effectiveness, it's just that the latest studies of it show that it's not very effective, so it never was very effective, but Paxlovid is really the go-to drug at this point, and there's other antiviral medications that are in development. So antivirals are a very promising thing. It's a way of, you know, if you can't prevent infection, if you can prevent its complications, that's still a very worthy goal.
Great. And then great to hear you talk about ventilation. I've been, you know, beating that drum since the beginning, and you know, even the small business that was set up to kind of test folks' ventilation has had almost no interest. So let's keep beating that drum. Not really a question there. My other question is about the emergency response. You said we need to start planning for the next pandemic. And, you know, if memory serves, when this started, we didn't have enough masks, because after SARS, they kind of stopped buying the masks that were made domestically. And I'm wondering, are we on the federal level doing a better job about not just treating the burning house, but also the aftermath and the next house to burn with keeping our national stockpile up of the mitigations that we know are effective?
Unfortunately, as far as I can tell, the answer to that is no. Mm-hmm. We're not addressing that. There's a plan to address it. There's an $88 billion request from the administration to do the next phase of preparedness and to develop the next generation of vaccines and to replenish stockpiles. But what I've been told is that that legislation is going nowhere in Congress right now. But it needs to. It needs to be on a fast track because it's, you know, not only does COVID have more in store for us, but an influenza pandemic. There are strains of influenza that could occur that would make COVID look like a walk in the park, where fatality rates, you know, are in the 1 to 2 to 3% range. So tens of millions of people could die in an influenza pandemic in the United States if we did not respond to it well. So, you know, we've been trying to prepare for that for decades, but we need to keep on the guard for it.
Okay. Thank you. But I have more questions, but we've got some KPTZ questions, so I'll hold the rest of them.
I know I saw a couple of KPTZ questions, and I have one question, but I think it's more in Willie's wheelhouse, so I'll hold questions for now. I know there were a couple of KPTZ questions, at least.
Well, I'll jump into those real quickly. Here is that the first is for someone who's going to be hospitalized and have surgery soon, and is really wondering if the surgical mask is good enough to protect them in the hospital, or whether they should be using a higher grade mask like an N95 or a KN95. And to that, I'd say that, you know, certainly there's a difference in masks. So the high efficiency particulate masks like N95 are still the gold standard for protection, literally filtering out about 95% of airborne particles. Surgical masks in comparison are around 60%. But the question here is, do you need that gold standard in a hospital setting? And the answer is probably not. Hospitals, you know, unless you're in an ICU or in a, you know, in a room with someone with COVID, are actually very low risk situations for transmission. And that's because there are such stringent infection control practices in place. So it's one of the safest places you can be. I think that if a person wanted to use a higher standard and wanted to wear an N95 mask in that setting, I think they should be allowed, you know, as long as it doesn't obstruct their breathing or cause problems. But my personal advice is I would be comfortable with a regular surgical mask in a hospital setting, because I know the people in the hospital are doing a really good job at making that a safe environment to be in. And then the second question is asking about availability of Novavax vaccine as a booster. And I just heard from the health department staff that this is available now locally. The Novavax, in addition to being approved as a primary series, it now is approved as a booster for people 18 years of age and older. It's approved for the primary series for 12 years of age and older. The caveats are that it's, number one, it's a monovalent vaccine. So it's based on the original COVID strain. It's not been updated for BA4 or 5. It's mostly for those for use as a booster for those who can't or won't use the messenger RNA booster, because we think the mRNA boosters are superior. You're not eligible for it if you've already had a messenger RNA booster. So it's Novavax is licensed if you need a booster. Even if your primary series with messenger RNA, you can use a Novavax booster. And then finally, you need to wait for 6 months after the completion of your primary series to get a Novavax booster. But with those conditions, it is available. And if people are seeking that, I've been told they should contact the health department and we can find him a way to get a booster.
Great. Any other questions? Monty, do you have any questions for Dr. Locke? Monty's standing in again as our county administrator. Mark McCauley is on his last day of vacation. I hope he's having last moments of fun. So let's hear from Willie. Good morning, Willie.
Hey, good morning, everyone. And welcome back, Dr. Locke. Good to see you again. We wrapped up with our final mass vaccination clinic, potentially of the pandemic, on Saturday. And when I reported out last week, we were talking how it was specifically for 5 to 11 year olds, as well as teenagers up to 18. Because of relatively low registration, at least we were able to handle some more folks. We did open that up to adults 18 and up as well. We had a little over 100 actually registered for the clinic beforehand. But then we had almost 60 walk-ins to the clinic that day, which was a record for us. I think that spoke to the fact that folks were realizing this was the last opportunity to get the vaccine in this particular setting. So they took advantage of the open clinic. All told, a little over 150 vaccinated on Saturday. This week, we are demobilizing our equipment, working to inventory and put it into storage. But still have it readily available should the need arise again in the future. To Commissioner Brotherton's question about staging equipment, and on a national level, things aren't looking so great as Dr. Locke talked about. Here locally, though, again, we have all of our equipment to be able to deploy a mass vaccination clinic relatively quickly. We do still have a decent stock of surgicals, a couple different types of N95s. A lot of them aren't the optimal brand and fit for a lot of our emergency response partners, but we have them nevertheless, as well as a smattering of medical supplies as well that we'll be keeping in storage for a quick deployment should the need arise. So that is a big change for us. A lot of this in terms of masking and medical supplies, all the equipment for a easily deployable mass vaccination clinic wasn't something we had going into this pandemic. This was all stuff that we had purchased in the heat of the moment to get this up and running, but we do have it here locally now, ready and available for quick deployment for the next potential pandemic. So other than that, that wraps up our mass vaccination clinic schedule with the funding ending at the end of the month. We are ready, willing, and able should the need spin up again. Other than that, of course, the shakeout was last week. Thank you to everyone who participated in that drill, however big or small, whatever your participation looked like. A special shout out to VCOM, our Volunteer Emergency Communications Group, our ham amateur radio operators who ran a successful communications drill, as well as all the in-prep neighborhoods who participated in their own drill in their own ways. Particularly the Bell Street neighborhood did a pilot project for us as we're exploring some new ways to expand our in-prep program. So shout out to them, as well as Port Ludlow, who they had over 150 people participate in their shakeout drill this year, doubling their number from last year. So huge thanks there. As always, if you don't live in an in-prep neighborhood, or if you don't know whether or not you lived in an organized neighborhood, head to our website or the local 2020 website to get involved. Other than that, we look forward to the shakeout next year. That's the end of my report. It sounded like there was at least one question for me, so I'll be happy to answer that.
Well, I was just, it was me, and I did participate in the Max Vaccination Clinic on Saturday. Thank you for opening that up for adults. And I just am struck by the relatively low percentage of folks in our community who've gotten the bivalent booster, relatively low percentage compared to last, previous rounds of the vaccination. And so just wondering if we want to remind people where to go to get their booster, and if there would ever be the possibility of having another clinic of some sorts, or partnering with the pharmacies, or I don't know, having a different model for getting more of these boosters out there. I'm just concerned with the low percentage of folks in our community who've gotten it.
Yes. So the vaccine is still available at our local pharmacies. So Safeway, Tri-Area, or through your healthcare provider. So talk to them if you're looking for options. You're also still welcome to call us here at DEM. And we can help find you an appointment if you have questions about where to go. If you do travel outside of the county for any reason, it is much more available in some of the more populated areas where you can go to Walmart, Walgreens, CVS, any of those major chain pharmacies as well. And there's plenty of availability there. I would be, and this was a helpful reminder, Commissioner Eisenhower, there is another clinic that's actually not being run by us. So it wasn't on the tip of my tongue, but the Washington State Department of Health have what they call a mobile care van, which offers mobile vaccination services. They will be here on the 30th, which is a Sunday of this month, at the Quimper Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Port Townsend from 1 to 4. So another opportunity for folks to go and get vaccinated on the weekends, Sunday the 30th, 1 to 4. Go to the Jefferson County Public Health website, call us at DEM if you need to snag an appointment for that. Otherwise, I think it was Commissioner Dean who mentioned there is a little bit of vaccine fatigue. So early on in the pandemic, it was about, the vaccine was being pretty carefully rationed, and then there were very limited supplies, so it was tough to come by. It was often difficult for folks to kind of sneak in and snag an appointment on relatively short notice as it was becoming available. Now the vaccine is widely available. You can walk into just about any pharmacy and go get vaccinated. But folks have already had 3, maybe even 4 shots, and a 4th or a 5th seems a little daunting. But as Dr. Barry has talked about, as Dr. Locke has talked about, it really does provide excellent protection against the latest variant. So we're really hoping that even though folks might be a little bit fatigued, we'll continue on with our messaging, asking folks to really consider this going into the winter weather season. I just really hope that folks consider this booster before we start seeing the next spike due to folks who aren't vaccinated against this particular variant. So, please call us. We're happy to walk you through your options. And we do have volunteers who are no longer busy every week. And if you need to talk to a doctor, please talk to your healthcare professional. Happy to walk you through the process here if you have any final questions.
I was just surprised at the number of people who didn't know what the alarm was for the shakeout, the great shakeout. I'm like, what? People, on Facebook and next door and saying, what's that tone? And I'm like, oh, come on. So nice work on that. And we still have a lot more community education to do. And it's incumbent on all of us to help get the word out about those events. So, yeah. Any other questions for Willie?
I have one more quick question for Dr. Locke, as we have a moment or two. And that's just, unfortunately, I got my second case of COVID a couple of weeks ago, and wondering, can you remind us how long after a case of COVID should you get the bivalent booster? How long should you wait for maximum effectiveness?
There's some variation in recommendations on that. Technically, to be eligible, you only have to wait 2 weeks. So you can legally qualify. But really, it's unnecessary to get vaccinated in 2, probably even 3 months after the infection. And if you do, you don't benefit from it much because your antibody levels are so high, they just sort of eat up the antigen that the vaccine produces. So the recommendation, what I recommend, is 3 months minimum. And there are some credible experts that say waiting as long as 6 months is optimal. So recommendations vary from 3 to 6 months, but I would go for 3 months.
Great. And then I asked a question to Dr. Locke, I think last week or the week before, but as we expand sewage monitoring, is there any push on the local or national level to expand to the flu as well, so we can kind of track that? And then a question I ask you all the time is, where did the flu go when it was gone? So it's like festering and a few people have it. Can you just talk kind of about the epidemiological narrative that has been the flu kind of gone for 2 years and now back, you know, as we remove our other mitigations?
Well, first of all, with wastewater, I've not heard people talking about monitoring for flu. There are efforts to monitor for poliovirus. There's some work on MPV monitoring, but and it would be technically possible to do it for flu. The answer with where does flu go? It never really goes away. We see sporadic cases throughout the year. There's areas in the world, the closer you get to the hemisphere, or I'm sorry, closer you get to the equator, the less seasonal flu becomes. So if you're in an equatorial country, they get sporadic flu all year round, and they have no seasonal increase. And the more northerly or southerly your latitude, the more seasonal flu is. And tends to cluster in outbreak periods, but it's always around smolder. And influenza, like all contagious diseases, it's kind of a chain reaction phenomenon, that when you have a susceptible population and it enters that population, it grows exponentially because as it moves person to person. And as long as the conditions are favorable for it to do that, and with all our masking and distancing, we made conditions unfavorable. So we could, if we did that every year, we would not have seasonal flu. There's also a really interesting study that if we were somehow able to vaccinate all school-age children for influenza, we also wouldn't have seasonal flu. It just wouldn't be able to take off and spread to the community, but we're not there yet. And our flu vaccines, unfortunately, are not nearly as effective as our COVID vaccines, but that may change. There's some really promising flu vaccines in the pipeline, messenger RNA based, and then what's called an M protein vaccine, which lasts multiple seasons. So you don't have to have a booster every year. Those things I think are gonna become a reality in the not too distant future.
Thank you. And great to hear from Willie that we have a local stockpile. At least we've learned some of the lessons locally. So let's open up the windows and keep the HEPA filters going this winter.
Unless it's too cold.
Hey, put a sweater on.
Put a sweater on. Yep. Thanks, you guys. Appreciate you being here today. And as I mentioned earlier, this is our last weekly update for a while. We're going to go to a monthly update schedule on the third Mondays of each month at 9:45. So same time, same place, but just once a month on KPTZ. And thanks to our friends at KPTZ for all of their service to the community over the last couple of years with these weekly updates and changing their programming schedules around. We really appreciate rising to the occasion with us. Super grateful for having a local radio station. So I think we're gonna sign you guys off and move on to a discussion of our Open Public Meetings Act.